This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Into the 7 o'clock hour we go. Payne and Pendergast with you. Sports Radio 610. Appreciate you tuning in. Bill O'Brien, Seth, I feel bad saying this because it's kind of something that you just did like 4 minutes ago.
What did I do?
Something that Bill O'Brien does that you did, not to the extent that he does.
I didn't know. That was not, look, that wasn't me that farted, Sean, if that's
no,
what
you're claiming. No.
That was one of the other people down the hall.
I mean, I'm sure he farts. We all do, yeah. But that's not what I was talking about.
Not me.
No, this is something more egregious than farting. It's taking the moving of the football by the offense in a game that is largely a blowout, and then sort of blanket telling folks, hey, we moved the football in this game.
Well, isn't that the objective, really, at the end of the day, moving the football?
Here was.
Hey, first it was here, and then it was there. This ain't rocket surgery, fella. We're doing what we needs to do.
Rocket surgery. So Bill O'Brien was asked yesterday if there would be change. I think it was Sarah Barshop who asked this question. Hey, Bill, after the first game, are you going to make any tweaks? Are you going to make any changes to the offense? Here's what he had to say.
You know, we moved the ball. I mean, we moved the ball. It was too little too late. But, no, we just need to have a good week of practice and just keep trying to get better.
All right, so we moved the ball. Hey, look, we moved the ball. Here, Seth, here's what I would point out. And I'm going to point out another instance where he did this last season. A more egregious instance in just a second. But this is my concern, and you brought this up earlier when he left Arian Foster in that game back in 2015. Like, why is he still in there? I do think that there's part of Bill O'Brien that likes to have the box score look better than the game actually looked to the human eye at the end of the game. And maybe other coaches do this, but the only coach that I watch on a snap-to-snap basis on a weekly basis is Bill O'Brien. And what I would point out is that prior to the Chiefs building a 31-7 lead in this game, the Texans ran 39 plays for 210 yards. 5.4 yards per play. Not awful. You're right. That's not a horrible number. The Chiefs ran 60 plays for 374 yards. That's 6.2 yards per play. Okay, so yeah, they moved the football a little bit, but the Chiefs did a better job. After it was 31-7, presumably when the Chiefs are like, all right, we just need to get the hell out of here. Let's not get anybody hurt. We're playing against the clock. We're not really playing against the Texans anymore. The Texans ran 19 plays for 150 yards, nearly 8 yards per play. The Chiefs ran 7 plays for -5 yards. The classic case of let's just get the hell out of here and go home. So did you move the football? Hey, you moved the football better than maybe you did in some of your other blowout losses before it got bad. But really the part you're referring to is after the Chiefs had folded up their tents and gone home. Like, yeah, you moved the football, you scored a couple touchdowns, but they're meaningless touchdowns. It makes me think that Bill O'Brien has a fantasy team, if you want to know the truth. It makes me feel like, look, I got Will Fuller in my fantasy league. Just take a look. He had 8 catches for 112 yards. I mean, come on. You know, Deshaun did get into the end zone through the air and on the ground. I mean, look.
I guess if you're playing fantasy, though, ultimately you want to score a bunch of points at some point. You do want to get those touchdowns, and I think that this is where a little bit of O'Brien's obsession with the run sometimes maybe gets in his way, because he's so focused on moving the ball and moving the sticks and methodically, hey, if we get 3 yards, then it's 2nd and 7. Isn't that fantabulous? And then, hey, if we get 3 more yards, it's 3rd and 4, and we're basically going to the Super Bowl because we got a 3rd and 4. I think, I don't know if that's the way the modern NFL works. Now, it could perhaps work that way if you have a genuinely stud rushing attack. But the Texans, when they run the ball well, tend to do it with volume more than anything else. I will say, Sean, I think I prefer Bill O'Brien's mediocre milquetoast version of success compared to Kubiak's, which at times was, hey, we won the time of possession. Remember, it was like, you get beat by 21 points, but as long as you had 35 minutes time of possession, you controlled the game.
Right. No, at least O'Brien's going for yards. There's no fantasy owners out there that get points for time of possession. Oh, so that's
no, no team was better at winning time of possession in a loss than the Texans. It was great under the Kubiak era.
Seth, here's probably the most egregious version of what it is I'm asking Bill O'Brien to stop doing. I'm asking Bill O'Brien to stop reminding us after horrible losses that, hey, we did move the football. Probably the most egregious one, remember this? After the Denver game last year, where the Texans fell behind 38-3, and then once they were behind 38-3, they started to get the offense going a little bit. They actually had 248 yards of offense after falling behind 38-3, and Bill O'Brien had this little exchange after the game.
We ran the ball for over 100 yards. I mean, it was a horrible game, but like the offensive line, again, we had some issues with penalties, like has been pointed out 50 times between the last two press conferences, rightfully so.
There are also some situations where we saw Bradley, Roby, and Jonathan Joseph on the sideline.
I mean, there were some things on offense that were pretty good. I'm not sure if you guys watched the film, but look, I know it was a terrible game, but just throw that out there. It wasn't horrible on offense.
Okay, and here's what I would point out about that game. Seth, I went and did the research.
Yeah.
Prior to the score becoming 38-3 against the Broncos at home in week 14, the Texans ran 37 plays for 166 yards. That's 4.5 yards per play. That's bad. That's not good. For those who don't know, that's a bad number. The Broncos ran 38 plays for 320 yards. That's 8.4 yards per play. That's eye-popping. After it was 38-3, well, then the Texans got it going. They had 38 plays for 248 yards. That's 6.5 yards per play. The Broncos, again, like most teams up 38-3, just wanted to get the hell out of there. They only ran 17 plays the rest of the day. So the Texans increased their yards per play by 2 full yards after falling behind by 5 touchdowns. That does not count as moving. The only time of the game where we care about the team moving the ball is when the game is still being contested by both teams.
Is that, I guess, my question, I guess, is it the fact that the Texans were moving the ball so well, is that why Bill O'Brien was so angry that he tried to leap up and choke a fan at the halftime of that game?
That's a great point.
Is it because things were going so splendidly that he just felt like, yeah, you know what? We don't even have to make any halftime adjustments. I'm gonna get into it with this stupid MF-er.
Yeah, it's a great point. I'm not saying this out of complete anger at Bill O'Brien. I'm giving him advice. It sounds tone deaf when he does this. It's infuriating when he does this.
I think that there's a couple things going on, which is one, and this is what I'm trying to figure out. I think it's okay to tell your team this stuff. This is where, especially the old theory of, you know, you want to kick them. When everybody else wants to hug them, you need to kick them. When everybody else wants to kick them, you need to hug them. So right now, everybody in the world wants to kick the Texans while they're down. So it's up to the coach to kind of get the confidence back into them, let them know, look, hey, we need to build on this. Look at the good things you did in that game. This isn't just going to be a matter of the Ravens coming in and kicking our ass because we suck. Like, no, we did some good things. What I would worry about, I guess, is that Bill O'Brien is the general manager, and he needs to understand that he has to wear two hats. He has to be maybe the guy that infuses some confidence into his team, but also he has to take an honest look at his team and say, all right, is moving the ball enough, and why did we fail at moving the ball? What do we need to clean up? Because those things ultimately are the things that make you a really bad football team. It's a slippery slope of forgiving yourself for bad performances. And I think that, yeah, Sometimes O'Brien says, hey, we ran for over 100 yards in that game with such defiance that I think in his mind, he really does think that it was a good rushing performance.
Right.
Like, rushing for over 100 yards when half of it comes in garbage time is not a good rushing performance. It's the exact opposite. That's the part that confuses
me. Yeah, and I think that's the frustrating thing. I think he knows this. Like, I think Bill O'Brien knows this, and if he knows it, then it makes it even worse because then it is him being just tone deaf. You know what I mean? Just then, it's just then you know you're pissing people off. Like the fans are not the. We all watched that game from beginning to end. We know that you didn't move the foot. Whether it was the Denver game last year, the Kansas City game 5 days ago, you did not move the football when you needed to move the football.
But and that's again where I wonder though too. It's. I don't care if that's what he's saying even to the media. Like, I kind of respect the coach that genuinely doesn't give a damn what he says to the media or what the media thinks of him. I worry about that he actually believes it.
Okay.
And that's what scares me is because as the general manager, he can't. Like, he also can't be a guy that thinks, wow, yeah, these guys are all good guys. We should pay them all a bunch of money.
Yeah.
Like, you're not allowed to do that as a general manager. It's a nice thought and it's a nice theory. And I know you've got the head coach whisperer in your ear, Jack Easterby, telling you that it's all about culture. At some point, you got to make sound financial decisions too, and I worry that what he's telling the media is actually what he believes.
What I would tell him too, Seth, is look, if you're going to turn this into a statistical war with the media or with fans, that's not a war you want to go fighting right now. As you've pointed out many times, they've never finished in the top half of the league in DVOA offensively. You're bringing a butter knife to a gunfight if you want to turn this into a statistical war.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. You talk about moving the ball. You haven't even done that well. Just by conventional stats, in terms of passing offense, and like how many yards passing do you have in the season? Simplest thing in the world. They've never been better than 15th.
Yeah.
You know who had a better passing offense last year than the Texans have ever had? Ryan Fitzpatrick with the Miami Dolphins.
Wow.
They finished 13th in passing offense.
Yeah.
The Texans had Ryan Fitzpatrick with a much better football team around him, and they never did better than 15th. They were way lower under Ryan Fitzpatrick. So, yeah, like they haven't even been much better than top half of the league or even approach to the top half of the league, and that includes at least two full seasons with DeAndre Hopkins or Deshaun Watson.
So Bill O'Brien, as usual, is getting the brunt of it from us on this show. I think getting the brunt of it on the text page around town. He's the head coach. It's to be expected. I think he knows that too. How soon until we're saying this about Deshaun Watson? That's next. Bill O'Brien yesterday in his press conference was asked to grade Deshaun Watson's performance. Maybe not grade it, but just what'd you think of Deshaun Watson against the Kansas City Chiefs after looking at the film?
I thought he played a very tough game. He played really, an aggressive, confident game. He got us into the right plays. He was able to adjust protections. I just thought overall he played a good football game. I think that, there's always areas for everybody to improve, and I'll just keep those between myself and the players. I wouldn't really get into all that with the media. So, no, I think he played a good football game, a solid game, and, because of his work ethic, he's going to continue to get better and better, and the work ethic of the guys around him, they're going to get better and better.
I believe most of what he's saying there, Seth, and I would say this, that in a game where he's saying publicly that the quarterback got them into the right protections, the Texans gave up pressure on nearly half of the passing snaps, on nearly half of Deshaun Watson's dropbacks, I think 45.5%, he was facing pressure. And if you go back and rewatch the game, it matches the eye test. Deshaun was running for his life back there quite a bit.
And at times in previous years, you could make a partial excuse for the offensive line because some of the pressures would be when Deshaun was holding onto the ball too long. That wasn't the case Thursday night. That was just your classic bad offensive line performance, And O'Brien, sometimes he's just sticking up for his guys and not criticizing him publicly. But when you say that an offensive line plays well except for some of the bad plays. Like, no. The bad plays are your performance. It drives me insane when offensive linemen will say, well, I had an incredible game except for my two bad plays. Like, yeah, your quarterback got killed on those two bad plays. That's all that matters.
Right.
That's like a cornerback saying, well, I played an incredible game except for the two touchdowns I left. You're paid to be consistent. That's what your job is to not make the big errors.
A neurosurgeon. Can you imagine a neurosurgeon saying that? You're like, hey, man, I've been a relatively perfect perfect neurosurgeon other than the two brains that I messed up. What do you want from me?
Look, the one time I forgot to put the brain back in the person's skull, you're going to judge me by that my entire
Everybody
life?
Everybody makes mistakes, all right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's that. I will say, though, I think there were a couple times where Deshaun forced the ball into – you know, it forced the ball into cover too deep where he didn't need to or shouldn't have. But I'll almost give him a partial break on a couple of those because I think the guys ran the wrong routes. And I know on one of the Will Fuller deep balls where Deshaun was doing his mime thing afterwards where he was trying to, you know, show that somebody did the wrong thing, the Texans left Frank Clark completely unblocked on that play, which – it did not look like a mental error necessarily by Titus Howard. I think that was the design, which means the ball was supposed to come out really fast. So I'm guessing that somebody ran the wrong route, and what Deshaun wanted to see wasn't there, so he just launched it deep. You know, on a relatively – he did a good job launching it deep where it was safely out of bounds. Maybe Fuller could have made an incredible catch. But so that's a receiver error. There were another couple plays in the game where it looked like Deshaun – didn't have options underneath where he was supposed to have options underneath. Now, I'll put that on Tim Kelly. I'll put that on the receivers coach. I'll put that on the receivers themselves, these veteran wide receivers that are supposed to know what the hell they're doing. But I'll also put it on Deshaun. At some point, you got to be Tom Brady. You got to be the guy that's so demanding of your receivers that they run the right routes. That's one of the things that makes Tom Brady so awesome. He's the best wide receivers coach in the damn league.
Yeah.
He just does not accept anything else that less than perfection from his wide receivers. And maybe that's where Deshaun needs to be a little bit more of a taskmaster.
Seth, I mentioned earlier that I spent some time yesterday on the radio.com app kind of bouncing around to the different stations in some of the cities that experienced similar week ones to the Texans just to see what the hosts and the fans in those cities sounded like, to see if their mindset was similar to ours. And most of it was very similar, except for one thing. The two cities that I dialed into most focused in the most focused fashion, Cleveland and Philadelphia, both those cities, from a host standpoint, a fan standpoint, they want their quarterbacks' heads on a spike. They're done with Baker Mayfield in Cleveland. And the host that I was listening to Philadelphia, I was listening to their midday show, and they're done with Carson Wentz. They don't think Wentz is the guy who can get them to the next level, and Wentz is the one I want to focus on, because here's what I found interesting. They were saying a lot of the same things about Carson Wentz that we've been saying about Deshaun Watson for the last few years. And let's keep in mind, Wentz was the second overall pick the year before Watson got into the league. Wentz got paid a big contract a year ago. Watson got paid his a week ago or a week and a half ago. So it's almost like Deshaun is a week behind or a year behind Carson Wentz in all this stuff. You know, Carson Wentz has experienced some success, a near MVP season in 2017, and the Eagles went on to win the Super Bowl without him under center. But they were a lot of the things they were saying, Seth, just stylistically, you could Mad Lib Deshaun Watson's name into those paragraphs or those statements. And it sounds like things we're saying. Carson Wentz holds on to the ball too long. Carson Wentz tries to make something out of nothing too much. Carson Wentz is careless with his body sometimes. They were describing Carson Wentz in a way that when we've been critical of Deshaun Watson, we've been describing Deshaun Watson, and it got me to thinking, look, this Baltimore game this weekend, there's not a lot of people expecting the Texans to win. But Deshaun has signed a new deal. He is now the second highest paid player in the history of the NFL. This is one of these games where Deshaun Watson is expected to, going forward, be able to win games like this, or at the very least be able to compete with the Ravens better than they did last year in losing 41-7. I guess my question is this. We're not at that point yet with Deshaun where we're saying the things they were saying about Carson Wentz, but how far off are we from that? Like, what are we, a 6-10 season away from that, or are we 3 more weeks away? The Texans could very easily start this season 0-4 against the Ravens, Steelers, and Vikings in the next 3 games. Like, when is the tipping point for when we're saying some of the things here that they were saying about Carson Wentz in Philadelphia?
I think you have to see... Well, for one, let's see. Last year, the Carolina game, the Baltimore game itself, there were a few instances where Deshaun, first half of the Bills game, where Deshaun clearly didn't look like a championship caliber quarterback, right? That was really what Deshaun last year was. This is, I'm not making excuses for him at all. He needs to be more consistent. But it's that classic thing where if you take his 12 best games, he's an MVP candidate. Yep. The problem is you have to also average in his four worst games. Right. And he was so bad in his bad games.
The bad games count too, like you were just saying.
Right, right. Yeah. So like the four bad games were so bad that they knocked him out of that MVP discussion. That's the biggest issue is at some point, where do you even those things out, and where are you in competitive in 16 straight games? Now, look, every quarterback that's ever played has stinkers of games. You know, Tom Brady has had four interception games before. It's just a matter of, in some of these games where things aren't perfect, are you still playing better than your average quarterback, even to, you know, despite the mistakes?
Yeah.
I guess that's the difference. Sometimes really good quarterbacks will have bad games where they have multiple interceptions, yet the other drives they're looking very good. Deshaun has some games where it just looks like he can't get anything going.
Yeah.
I'm not making excuses for the week one performance. I saw enough good out there. And I saw enough that I can blame on other people in the offense that I don't think Deshaun was the problem.
Yeah. Look, he's not been above criticism. We've criticized him on the show before, and fans have been critical of Deshaun. I still do think that he, oddly enough, in year four is still in somewhat of a honeymoon phase, and I think some of that may have to do with the fact that his head coach takes a lot of the bullets for him. You know, his head coach is a lightning rod for criticism, and there's only so much criticism maybe or so much energy to go around in terms of being critical of people. The thing that I heard yesterday, Seth, in listening to fans of the Browns and of the Eagles was that he's not the guy. He's not the guy who's going to get us to where we want to get. I still think we're at least a year away before fans are saying that about Deshaun Watson. And if the Texans win another division this year, we're probably another few years away. But fans are not that patient, man. You can perform at an MVP level and still ask James Harden. You can perform at an MVP level every year, and fans will be like, you're not the guy. You're not going to get us to where we want to get to.
I'll tell you what. Tell me, are you like this? I wonder if our listeners are like this. Text in 713-572-4610. I try not to be like this, but, man, there's something that maybe is just human nature. Maybe I'm a just spiteful person or something. Once somebody gets paid, it's different.
Yes.
Like, once somebody gets paid, I'm like, all right, here we go. Like, the prove-it period is over. That's how I am with Zach Cunningham. I was kind of very patient last year with these coverage issues that he has, and I didn't even really want to point it out all that much because he was a young player. Now that he's got paid, no. Your two PBUs last year, your two passes defended last year, not going to cut it.
Right.
You know, your sparse interceptions throughout the last several years, not going to cut it. You need to start being better in pass coverage. I would say Laremy Tunsil. No. You get a $22 million a year in extension. You're not allowed to continue jumping off sides. You're not allowed to just bury your head in a defensive tackle and ignore a guy coming around the end. You're not allowed to make these boneheaded decisions anymore. And I think with Deshaun, yes, it turns into now you're the $39 million a year quarterback. You're getting paid to be above and beyond. So, yes, my standards are a little bit higher. I don't know if it should be based on money like that, but it is, damn it.
It shouldn't always be based on – this is the second biggest contract in the history of the league. He plays the most important position on the team. And he, unfortunately for him, and maybe fortunately, Deshaun seems like somebody who's up to the challenge. The guy he's always going to be compared to is the guy who is off to the greatest start in the history of an NFL career in Patrick Mahomes. That's the standard right now. And that's the guy you just played – this past week, and you fell behind 31-7. Heavy is the head that wears the crown. That's all I'll say about that.
Real good point from a listener, I think. And I think this kind of paints it out perfectly how a lot of people feel about it. Fans will not say that about Deshaun until they see how he will play under a different offense, period.
Right.
And I think that's what happened with Baker Mayfield.
Yep.
I think with Baker Mayfield, they said, okay, new coach this year. It'll be different, right? So now it's a new coach, and Stefanski's probably not the problem. So, hey, okay, it's Baker Mayfield.
The worst take on the Major League Baseball playoffs that I've heard yet involving the Astros. We will get to that next. All right, so the Astros are back in action tonight. They finally hit the easy part of their schedule. They need it. The A's and the Mariners split yesterday, by the way. So the Mariners remain a game and a half back of the Astros for second place in the AL West, which comes with an automatic playoff berth this year. So there's this guy in New York who writes for the New York Post named Joel Sherman. And Seth, one of the very frustrating things about the way people are viewing this Astros season is that it seems like everybody from either New York or Los Angeles feels like they're speaking for Major League Baseball when they give their view on whether or not they want the Astros in the postseason or whether or not they're rooting for the Astros to lose. And here's what Joel Sherman, writer for the New York Post, lays out. That the headline is, MLB's perfect playoff is a Yankees dream and an Astros nightmare. And the argument that he makes is that despite all the weirdness of this season where we've seen massive amounts of doubleheaders involving seven-inning games, we saw games canceled because of player protests, we've seen games canceled because of weather, we've seen the coronavirus rip through a couple of clubhouses in Major League Baseball, that despite all, there's an expanded playoff, which we've never had before, where 16 teams get into the playoffs, that despite all of this, that despite all of what he likes to call the 1-2 cha-cha-cha needed to play this season, the postseason for Major League Baseball would choreograph, the postseason that MLB would choreograph, if it could, is still viable. And here are his bullet points for the ideal MLB postseason for what he thinks is in the eyes of Rob Manfred and the Major League Baseball folks. One, the Astros don't make the playoffs. Two, the five teams that have gone the longest without reaching the postseason get in. Three, they get the Dodgers and the Yankees to play in the World Series. I believe that number three is true. I believe that number two is true. I don't think for one minute that MLB, Rob Manfred, or anybody else that has anything to do with the business of baseball is rooting against the Astros to make the postseason. And of course, he cites the fact that they, you know, they don't want the Astros in the postseason because all it would do, especially because the Astros have underperformed this year, all it would do is just unleash a slew of, well, this is what happens when you're not getting the signs sent to you, jokes on the broadcasts and on social media, that all it would do would be spotlighting what is ostensibly a blight on Major League Baseball, the Astros stealing signs, even though everybody steals signs. My point, when I retweeted this yesterday, along with a GTFOH to Joel Sherman, is that if Major League Baseball was so caught up in not wanting the Astros to be front and center with anything, in wanting to hide the Astros like they're that drunk relative at the picnic that is going to embarrass you in front of your boss, that kind of thing, they wouldn't be putting them on national TV this weekend, not once but twice. Both of the Astro games against the Dodgers this weekend were on Fox and ESPN. I think it's ridiculous. Well,
and they also, I mean, again, if you've got any kind of conspiracy theory about it, the Astros finish out this season with the easiest schedule in the league for the remaining games. They have the easiest schedule. They got the Mariners. They got the D-backs. They've got a winning percentage of 0.4 something, 0.41 or whatever. Like, nobody has it easier heading into the playoffs. And you could have predicted that at the beginning of the year. It's not like all of a sudden, you know, if anything, it should be even worse because nobody thought the Mariners were going to be competitive at this point. So I think that the other side of this too, Sean, is aside from wanting the ratings or wanting the soap operas or the professional wrestling aspect of the, you know, the Dodgers versus the Astros, come watch the drama, come watch the dust up. I think that it's working out well so far for baseball where they can say, hey, look, we took care of the problem. Don't look at any of the other teams and every other potential cheating scandals. The Astros were the cheaters, and we took care of it. So even if they make the playoffs, I don't think baseball expects the Astros to go far, not with the way things have gone so far. Yeah. So they'll end up being able to say, yeah, this was we had a problem. We took care of it, and I'm actually a good commissioner, everybody. Stop being so mean to me.
That's interesting you say that because I think you could – look – I think you can make an argument that Rob Manfred actually would be rooting for the opposite of what Sherman is talking about here. I think you can make an argument that the commissioner of Major League Baseball would be rooting for the Astros to go win, you know, I know it's a 60-game season, but the equivalent of 102 games, whatever that number is in a 60-game season, that he would be rooting for them to go win 65% of their games again and make a deep playoff run, because then it would prove that the whole sign-stealing thing didn't really impact things back then. You know, this is still a great team that has been great. And I know 2019 they weren't stealing signs, although these ridiculous buzzer accusations are what they are. But I think if I'm Manfred, Seth, part of me would be rooting for the Astros to still be great, because then it would just show people, like, look, this stupid garbage can thing they were doing, it was stupid and it deserves to be punished, but there's not a tainted World Series out there. That was still the best team in baseball, because here we are 2 and 3 years later and they continue to be one of the best teams in baseball. Now they're a team that, to Sherman's point in this article, they're a team that's 118 points below their OPS from last year. They've gone from a they've gone from a nine-man equivalent of a really good hitter, an 848 OPS, to a nine-man equivalent of a decent hitting second baseman at 730. You know what I mean?
This Joel Sherman guy, the name sounds familiar. I feel like he's annoyed me at some point. So usually whatever I do when I want to smear somebody is I just Googled Joel Sherman racist just to find out. You know, at some point if you're a columnist, you're going to be accused of being racist. Right.
What'd you find
out? He does not approve of Yoenis Cespedes' antics in the way he carries himself throughout his career. Is that a big shock to you? My old standby used to be like Google the columnist name and controversy. The problem is there's just so much controversy in baseball right now. Yeah. I got back 400 results about Joel Sherman and the Astros.
It's like Googling his name with the word baseball.
Yeah. So I don't know. Let's see. He had a Joel Sherman article that decried Yoenis Cespedes. I can't say his name without saying the first name first. His antics. It sounds like a lot of Latino player antics.
There you go,
Joel Sherman.
There you go, Sherman.
Discredited, I say.
Seth, you asked for text message. Seth is on point when he says people get paid and how expectations should rise. To me, it's a linear slope. The more you get paid, the higher the expectations. It's the same in sports and in other jobs. A manager gives his employee a promotion and a raise. That employee better step it up and deliver more. I agree.
But I think that's because we were discussing Deshaun Watson, and at some point, if he doesn't take that next step, are people going to start crushing him? I really think that O'Brien is under so much scrutiny, and enough people will blame O'Brien for Deshaun's lack of further progress if he doesn't make it, that I think it's O'Brien. It's first, everybody's got a checklist in their man cave, and at the top it's fire Bill O'Brien, and then second after that would be, after that happens, reevaluate Deshaun Watson.
Right.
If they brought in, I don't know, whoever this year's equivalent of Kyle Shanahan or whoever else is going to be, and then Deshaun continued to underperform, then I think at that point you got a tough decision to make.
Let's drop a phone call in here. Kevin is up in Humble and wants in on the conversation. Kevin, you're on Payne and Pendergast. Good morning.
Well, good morning. So I want to make a comment first. I totally agree with Seth on what he just said about firing Bill O'Brien, and that's probably the number one thing out here. I personally do not believe that Deshaun Watson will improve as long as Bill O'Brien is the head coach. I do not feel that this team will win as long as he's the head coach. And this, when I watched the game Sunday, it became so obvious. You know, when they took the ball with 25 seconds left in the first half and went down and scored that field goal, you knew they weren't going to win. It was almost like not just the team, but the coaches gave up. The announcers even made the comment when they were playing at the end of the third or beginning of the fourth quarter, when they ran those five running plays in a row, that the Texans were playing like they were up by 17. It was like they were using this game as a preseason game to get ready for Baltimore.
I'm glad you mentioned the five run plays there too, because that kind of falls in line with what Sean was talking about, which is moving the ball is not the standard. You know, like, hey, we moved the ball. Like, somehow it feels like in Bill O'Brien's mind that as long as you move the ball, then at some point, you know, you're going to run into the end zone almost by accident. Like, I want to score with the football. I want huge chunks of yardage. And running the ball when you're in a complete passing situation, I think leads to things like maybe Deshaun throwing deep when he should be checking down in the third quarter at various instances there, because it feels like he's got to make up for the conservative play calling.
Yeah, Bill O'Brien talks like a fantasy owner sometimes after these games. You know, you lost to Denver 38-24, and you are voluntarily, by the way, not only voluntarily bringing up, hey, there were some good things that happened out there, interrupted a follow-up question to re-point out that there were good things going on. And now I realize that's a game from last year. I brought it up earlier in the show because he did it again after the Kansas City game. You know, he did it again yesterday where he's pointing out, hey, we moved the football. No, you lost 34-20. You largely moved the football after falling behind 31-7. It's not, I get it that it's a 60-minute game. Okay. We would love for the Texans to play a full 60 minutes one of these days. It's been a long, long time it's been a long time since the Texans have given you a game where they played 30 minutes of really good football, let alone 60 minutes. They've won a few of these games, but some of them they've been fortunate to win. I mean, I would submit you got to go back to the Patriot game maybe, and even that one they let the Patriots back in week 13. But back to O'Brien, the box score doesn't matter at the end of the game. Like that you move the football in the back half of the third quarter in the fourth quarter against a team that was completely disinterested and wanted to get the hell out of there means nothing to anybody except for the head coach.
Yeah, which is, look, yeah, it's the fourth quarter that matters, which that's the part that's so vexing, is that the Texans have actually been pretty good in the fourth quarter of these close games. They've won more close games than you would expect. It's these, and you know what, Sean, that's exactly why, in bringing up division championships or anything else like that, what gets so frustrating, I think, for Texans fans is that, yes, you get teased and tantalized with a good win-loss record, but then it's versus these really good teams, and especially in the playoffs, half of the time it ends up being the Chiefs in the playoffs, where you just get absolutely destroyed. Yeah. It's like, it's a little bit of a tease, isn't it? It's like, hey, yeah, you know what? I think we actually got something going here. And then all of a sudden the bully, you know what it's like, Sean? It's like you worked out all summer. You know, you're the kid that gets sand kicked in your face on the beach, and you get the Charles Atlas books, and you're going to start working out and getting bigger. And maybe you gain 10 or 15 pounds, and you show up to school all confident. You got some new clothes, and all of a sudden,
what happens?
And then all of a sudden, in third period, Nelson the bully comes over and gives you a wet willy, and then gives you a wedgie in front of the best-looking girl in the school, and kicks you in the butt down the stairs. Like, that's exactly what happened.
Square one, yeah.
Makes you feel like a Milhouse as a fan.
A Milhouse.
Yeah.
I like your Simpsons analogies. Let's do some headlines, Ben.
Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines.
Seth, we got the annual Monday Night Football doubleheader last night. Pittsburgh and the Giants in the first game. The Steelers win that game 26-16. And then in the nightcap, the Tennessee Titans go down to the wire with the Denver Broncos. Probably a game Tennessee should have won by more than they did. It took a last-second, ironically, a last-second field goal from Steven Gostkowski to win that game 16-14. Ironic, because he had missed three field goals and an extra point earlier in the game. Hey, Steve Levy was doing play-by-play for that second game. It was Chris Fowler and Kirk Herbstreit on the first game, and they got rave reviews from people who were watching. Steve Levy, not so much, and Steve Levy said something during the broadcast on that Tennessee-Denver game where I had to check and go, okay, am I the only one scratching my head on this? He called Steven Gostkowski a future Hall of Famer multiple times during the broadcast. If you're a kicker for the Patriots, does that automatically make you a future Hall of Famer? I mean, Vinatieri's a future Hall of Famer, largely because he's kicked a lot of really important game-winning field goals. Gostkowski, future Hall of Famer, and then he goes on to miss three field goals in that game. I feel like Steve Levy jinxed him in that game.
Sometimes, you know, kicking stats are always the weirdest, because at various times we'll be watching and some rando will be like, he's got the best field goal percentage ever! And then, like, 6 months later, he's cut.
Yeah.
I don't know if he is. Apparently, there's enough of a glow about Patriots kickers that maybe that's the deal.
Maybe.
I would say, you know what, Herbstreit is astoundingly good as a pro color commentator for a guy that spends the vast majority of his time on college football. Because usually, what'll happen when a college guy does pro stuff is that he keeps referencing back to guys' college careers in a way that's almost annoying. Like, it becomes really obvious that this guy knows way more about college football than pro football. Herbstreit, it was like, oh, Herbstreit actually knows more about pro football than it seems like half of the full-time pro color commentators.
Yeah,
this is making everybody look bad, Herbstreit. Settle the hell down.
It wouldn't shock me, Seth, if after this year, and I know it's only been one game for the Levy, Greasy, Riddick crew, but we know that, I don't know that ABC / ESPN sees them as the long-term crew on there. Would not shock me if they just came to Fowler and Herbstreit with a gigantic pile of money and said, here you go, guys. Take over. This is our most important property that we own is Monday Night Football.
Yeah, Herbstreit would be, boy, that would be, would Herbstreit try to do two things? Would he try to just add that onto his duties and still do all his college football stuff? Or do you think he would?
I think they could still do College Game Day. I don't know that they could still do the play-by-play and color for a game also on Saturday night. People don't realize how much those guys are on a private plane pretty much all day on Saturday going from wherever game day is to wherever their assignment is for the primetime game that night.
I think that if there's one thing I've learned in broadcasting, it's that guys like Herb Street or some of the play-by-play guys like Tirico Tirico will do an NBA game one day and then an NFL game the next and be like dropping knowledge on both of them.
Kevin Harlan,
yeah. I think that they're very, very systematic in their preparation, and they've got a system and a procedure that I bet Herb Street could do it both.
Yeah.
And by which he might become one of the most venerable and respected names in sports media history if he were to do that. Because I think he would be so front and center in both college and pro football, the number of people that would see him every single day. I think he should take this on. His boys are all teenagers. He said, he's got four teenage boys. He was talking about it on the broadcast.
Yeah.
So they'll be in college soon. But once they get to college, you just go ahead and do a tackle on your NFL and college. So.
Yeah. No, you make enough money to cover up whatever mistakes they may make as a young adult and buy their way out of it. They'll be fine without extra parenting. You'll be good to go.
That works out fabulously.
You'll be good
just
to go.
Turn them into little trust fund bastards.
That's right. Seth, of these two Monday night games, I would say my big takeaways from the early game, the Steelers and the Giants, is that I'm fearful for Deshaun Watson's life in week three of the season. The Texans play the Steelers.
Why are you waiting until week three? You know who was third in quarterback hits last year? The Ravens.
No, I know, but they didn't play last. In addition to the amount of hits he's going to take this weekend,
okay.
Because the Ravens didn't play last night, the Steelers did. I'm more fearful now that Deshaun Watson, let's put it this way. By the end of week four, because they play Minnesota, who I know was not good against Green Bay this past weekend, but they did trade for Yannick Ngakoue, and I'm assuming that Danielle Hunter is going to be healthy again by week four. That's a team that can put a rush on a pass or two.
Yeah.
This Texans offensive line better get their bleep together, man. I mean, these are Baltimore, Pittsburgh, and Minnesota are the next three assignments for this group that, they were pulling some Kendall Lambs out there. They were hitting their initial block and then standing there and watching as the guy they were blocking makes a run at their quarterback.
If, Sean, I'm going to tell you, based on the way that these first three defenses especially have played, but then also the potential for – look, week one is a little bit of a write-off. I'm not going to act like the Vikings have a horrible defense or anything now because they got gashed by a really good offense. But I would say if they get out of this first four games playing the way they did in game one, if they get out of these first four games at 2-2, I will be besides myself with happiness. And that's not lowering the bar. I think that would be a sign that if they end up 2-2 after these first four games, then they'll have figured a few things out with the offensive line. I think that David Johnson and everybody else will be a little bit more incorporated into the offense, actually a lot bit more, and they'll have a shot at a really, really good season. Now, that is a tall mountain to climb because they've got some serious challenges with these defenses they're about to face.
Okay, I want to take each side of the ball real quick along those lines because we have highlighted the mistakes from week one and our concerns for week two, and we will continue to do that throughout the course of the week. On the offensive side of the ball, is the bigger issue mental errors or physical talent?
On the offensive side of the ball, I think the bigger issue is mental errors at this point.
Okay, yeah. On the defensive...
I've got reservations about the offensive line's physical ability, but yes, mental at this point.
Which to me are more fixable. If it were physical talent, I'd be like, okay, well, they're screwed. You can't get good... You can't upgrade the talent until after the season in all likelihood. On the defensive side of the ball, are the issues more mental errors or physical talent?
In the short term, they were mental errors, and I'll include missed tackles as mental errors because the biggest issue with a missed tackle a lot of times is just the approach that you took, the angle that you took. So they just need to get sharper mentally on a lot of that. For long term, over the course of 16 games, the physical issues are going to be issues.
Yeah.
I don't know where they're going to get a pass rush right now. And a couple of these younger guys really got to emerge over the next couple of weeks because the same old guys, other than J.J. Watt, aren't getting it done right now.
Seth, my concern, especially for this weekend, is just the lack of speed in the front seven. Like, watching that, and I get it, the Steelers are the gold standard, but you watch that front seven operate last night, and you go, holy crap, look how fast. Not just Bud Dupree, not just T.J. Watt, they got a lot of speed. Even their big fat guys are very athletic. Hell, Cam Hayward had an interception last night in the game. Those are very athletic, twitchy, speedy guys. The Texans don't have guys like that.
Though, And that's what I was telling you, Sean. I think the hope for this year was that the Texans could become an average defense because of that. Because they don't have – they flat out don't have the horses that the Steelers do. The Steelers led the league in sacks last year and quarterback pressures, overall quarterback pressures. It wasn't just some fluke year. They can flat out get after it. So, yeah, I don't expect the Texans to get to that level anytime soon. That'll be in Bill O'Brien's 7th or 8th year as general manager. That maybe
I got you.
Point.
I got you. Yeah, right around the
so
time.
14, 15 years from now, or, well, 14 years into his tenure.
Sure, sure, sure. Meanwhile, speaking of Bill O'Brien, the Texans back at work yesterday getting ready for a really tough assignment this weekend against the Baltimore Ravens on Sunday. Kickoff 3:25. You can hear it right here on Sports Radio 610. The only real update from a medical standpoint, the only person missing from practice yesterday, quite honestly, was Duke Johnson, running back who suffered a leg injury in the opener against Kansas City. Here's Bill O'Brien's Duke Johnson update.
Duke is day-to-day. Duke's a tough guy. I mean, he'll see how it feels today. And then, you know, we got, you know, you have like an extra day or so, you know what I mean, because of the Thursday game. So that's a good thing. So we'll see how he's doing as the week progresses. And we feel good about the depth we have, you know. You know, we have some other guys there that could step up if Duke couldn't go.
All right, Seth, I'm looking at the depth chart at running back right now. The other guys that would be stepping up would be Buddy Howell, who I believe has like 4 carries in his career. Really good special teams player. Scotty Phillips, who has 0 carries in his professional career, just got called up to the active roster right before the Kansas City game. And C.J. Procise, who, while carrying a degree from a fine institution, does not have a ton of experience himself, did have a few games here and there for Seattle where you go, I think I might pick this guy up in my fantasy league, but has been banged up a lot in his career.
Yeah,
he's on the practice squad right now.
He doesn't have a lot of experience staying healthy.
No.
What? Let me ask you, Sean, this will be a little public service for our listeners. What site do you use for depth charts?
Our Lads.
Do you?
Yeah.
See, Our Lads, they used to be awesome. But now, and they're pretty good. OUR Lads, everybody, if you want it. I don't think they update as quickly as
Except the easiest thing to do might be just to go to the team. So the team site usually has a depth chart.
Yeah, I know. It's just a pain in the ass compared to just Our Lads used to be. Our Lads, back in the golden age of Our Lads, you know, you had one site where you could just, bam, pull up anything and sound like a genius because you knew who the 4th string running back
was. Back in my day, I would just call Our Lads and they would fax me a depth chart of the Texans.
I've been burned by Our Lads too many times where I'll just say, like, well, of course, you know, you got their 3rd-string running back such and such, and then my co-host will be like, yeah, he was cut 3 weeks ago.
Right.
Yeah, of course, that's what I meant. What, you see, that was a test. I was testing you.
That's right. That's right. So Duke Johnson, day-to-day, and we'll see what happens at the running back position. Meanwhile, up the road, up 45 in Dallas, one of the bigger injuries from the weekend, Seth, in the NFL – was the Cowboys losing one of their stud young inside linebackers, Leighton Vander Esch, out with a broken collarbone. Of course, that Cowboys defense is one that's built largely around the front 7. They signed Everson Griffin this offseason. They had hoped to have Gerald McCoy, but he tore a knee. He got cut. DeMarcus Lawrence, Jalen Smith had a pretty good game against the Rams on Sunday night. And Leighton Vander Esch, he's now out with a broken collarbone. I'm trying to think, was that the biggest injury of the weekend? For a league that is operating amidst a pandemic, and for a league that didn't have a real training camp and where a lot of guys haven't been taking hits, I feel like there have not been a ton. You know, Von Miller is probably the biggest injury, but that didn't happen in week one. It happened in training camp. I feel like the injuries have been a little less than what I expected them to be through training camp in week one of the NFL season.
Yeah, I would say there are two things that maybe surpassed expectations in a good way, which was, one, there are fewer injuries than I think people thought. Two, I think in general, I thought the football looked crisp enough across most. I think we were a little nervous after the Texans looked so sloppy on Thursday night that maybe that would be more the standard, but I think it was the exception. I thought I was pretty pleased with the football I was watching. Look, last night with that Giants-Steelers game, I thought that was a classic back-and-forth battle, right? The Giants had a great drive in the third quarter. but it ended in an interception in the end zone, but it was a forced interception. Like, I saw good football around. I thought the Chiefs, Sean, I thought the Chiefs played pretty sharp football in their debut. Yeah, it was all right. It was not
very
bad.
Precise in their attack.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, they were.
So I would say, yeah, and I think that it might speak to the fact that unlike the lockout year where there were a whole lot of extra injuries, there he didn't have any off-season activities, and then all of a sudden you jumped into a normal training camp where you still had combined practices with other teams. You had your preseason games. It's a lot of really violent action really fast. This was a very slow ramp-up. And maybe the model, I would honestly, like, as a player, if I were a player, I would hope that this trend continues, that the injury rates are better perhaps as the season begins, and maybe say, like, look, okay, a slow ramp up is the way to do it, and let's save our bodies for with the action that really matters, which is week one of the regular season.
Seth, one of the takes that you had yesterday when we were talking about the Patriots and the Dolphins, and I talked about Cam Newton. Hey, he went 15 for 19 for 115 yards, not a ton of yards through the air, but very efficient. 15 carries for 75 yards, and I said this might end up being the formula for the Patriots to go win some football games this year, is using Cam this way. And I know your concern was 15 carries ain't going to be it if they expect him to last the whole season. Well, Cam Newton was on the Greg Hill show on WEEI, our sister station up in Boston. And he went on that show yesterday and he said, balderdash, Seth Payne. This is what he said. He said, balderdash, Seth Payne. He said, that's just been me. Every year a new discussion comes up about it's not smart to run. It's not smart to do this. It's not smart to do that. But at the end of the day, I just feel as if whatever necessary way you have to go about winning a football game, that's what you have to do. So Cam Newton, Seth Payne, says you are full of malarkey. I can run the ball 15 times if I want to.
I would say I think that he probably, you know, I don't know if he was asked the direct question, do you plan on running the ball 240 times this year?
Yeah.
Because that is a big difference between doing what it takes, you know, in any particular game versus doing it all the time. And I like, how many total carries did Lamar Jackson have last year? I would say that Lamar Jackson,
he rushed for 1,200 yards. So
I know he rushed
for
1,200 yards, but is like Lamar Jackson actually probably does a better job of avoiding contact than Cam Newton. Part of that's out of necessity. He's not a big fella. But he also, like, Cam's a fullback playing. You know what Cam Newton is? He's Mike Allstott. He's like, okay, he's technically a fullback, but he actually just is so good at it that he looks like a running back. I think that's what Cam Newton is like. Okay, you want to say he's a running quarterback, but more he's like a fullback that plays quarterback really well. He takes a lot of abuse when he runs.
Yeah.
So I worry about him. Like, yes, I agree with his sentiment that go ahead and do what it takes to win a particular game. But the most he's ever rushed in a season is 139 times in 2017. I don't think he can run 15 times every game if that's going to be the recipe for success.
I don't think he can run 15. Just on paper, you're right, because you're increasing the odds of taking a big hit. I'll say this about Sunday's game, is that I watched it, and I rewatched the condensed version because I wanted to go back and see what did these 15 carries look like. By and large, they were 15 carries where he didn't take any big hits. They didn't run him between the tackles nearly as much as they used to in Carolina, Seth. A lot of them were busted plays, scrambling out of the pocket, looking downfield, nobody's open. So he tucks and runs and either slides or gets out of bounds. It was a very, very efficient and smart 15 carries by Cam Newton.
Okay, so yeah, he can do it that way then.
Well, he did it one game. I mean, we'll see if he, you know, my guess is that there'll be hits that get taken somewhere.
Really, if you break it down, do we expect Bill Belichick to perhaps get the most out of Cam Newton that anybody's ever gotten out of Cam Newton? I think that would be fair, right, to say that you should expect that as long as he stays healthy. That's my only concern with him is, can he stay healthy? I think they'll – and the only reason I bring up the, hey, you can't do 15 carries a game is that I think he will evolve beyond this. I think they're going to set it up this way over the first few weeks and get him comfortable, keep expanding the offense. And by week 8, by week 9, it's going to look like a different product than you saw in week 1.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.